This is Captain Rick reporting. I'll be reading from the Wednesday, April 26th edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. The first article is entitled, Decatur Feels Caterpillar Profit Growth. Peoria. Caterpillar Incorporated's profit engine roared back to life in first quarter results announced Tuesday, and the Resource Industries Division, which includes Decatur-based production, provided much of the financial fuel. Caterpillar said first quarter sales and revenues hit $9.8 billion, compared to $9.5 billion in the 2016 first quarter, and blew by industry analyst estimates of $550 million. Dragged down by hefty restructuring and layoff costs, however, profit per share came in at 32 cents, compared to 46 cents a share in 2016 first quarter. But take those layoff costs out, and the 2017 first quarter per share profit jumped to $1.28, doubling the comparable 2016 total of 64 cents. Also, this was the first time in 2 years that same quarter sales and revenues actually went up. But the real revival story was down in the engine bay of Resource Industries. After plunging to a $96 million loss in the first quarter of 2016, the first quarter 2017 numbers accelerated to a $158 million profit, a staggering turnaround of 265% from the 2016 first quarter. That was achieved on sales of $1.67 billion, up 15%, compared to $1.449 billion in the 2016 first quarter. Caterpillar said the Resource Industries revival was the prime driver of its better fortunes for the start of 2017. The increase was primarily due to higher sales volume, with the most significant increase in Resource Industries, the firm said in a statement. Decatur producers, among other products, the world's biggest off-ramp dump trucks, much loved by mining company customers, and one of Caterpillar's most profitable vehicles. The company reported that after a slump lasting years, mining customers are showing signs of life. Caterpillar has long maintained that a turnaround in Resource Industries, which caters mainly to mining, would be signaled first by an uptick in orders for parts. With sales improved for both new equipment and aftermarket parts, most of the increase was for aftermarket parts, which have increased sequentially in each of the last four quarters. The firm cautioned that it will need to see a more sustained and stabilized increase in commodity prices to drive longer-term mining demand, but is clearly feeling decidedly optimistic. Buoyed by its better-than-forecast first quarter 2017 numbers, Caterpillar raised full-year projected results to a range of $38 billion to $41 billion, with a midpoint of $3.95 billion. That contrasts with the previous forecast range of $36 billion to $39 billion, with a midpoint of $37.5 billion. Can Caterpillar keep it up? Investment advisor Jim Minton, who closely watches the stock, says we'll have to wait and see how sustainable it is. He's a little troubled that Caterpillar earnings per share before restructuring costs had bested analysts' estimates of some 66 cents. It was a significant best for me that kind of slows down the optimism a little bit, said Minton, who works with Investment Planners Incorporated in Decatur. It's kind of like, okay, who misfigured what? The estimates were just so far off. Grading numbers aside, as far as first quarter 2017 results go, Minton said good news is good news and a welcome change in tone from Caterpillar. There is some positive news, and so now there is something to build on, he said. Hopefully, they can get that done from the iron core and copper prices, which will create a better environment for Caterpillar if they continue to go higher. But sales linked to stronger orders from mine customers aren't the only thing that Caterpillar expects to see rise in the coming year. The company is already spending a fortune on restructuring costs related to layoffs and factory closures, hence that earnings per share dip, and it plans to spend even more. The next article is entitled "Frustrations Flare as Cemetery Director is Fired Again." Decatur. In what was called a redo of last week's meeting that the Decatur Township Cemetery Board still insisted did not violate the Illinois Open Meetings Act, the board on Tuesday once again fired Greenwood Cemetery Director Lynn Dixon. A week earlier, on Tuesday, April 18th, the board held a meeting in which it dismissed Dixon, who had overseen the operation of Greenwood and two other cemeteries under township control since 2014. Like at that meeting, a large contingent showed up to protest Dixon's firing. The room was full. People stood in the back, and the board heard a large number of them voice their concerns during the public comments portion, and also during discussion of why the board made the decision to fire Dixon. No one person had anything negative to say about him, said Murray Preston, attending the meeting. You can't, and I don't know anyone who can. You have a man of quality. You should treasure that. The meeting had a share of anger and snark from the crowd and some bizarre moments. At one point, Cemetery Board Trustee John Funk read aloud the minutes of last week's meeting, which covered the same ground as Tuesday's meeting, and the board approved the minutes. Regular township meeting attendee Jim Taylor questioned how the board could approve minutes of a meeting that wasn't legal. Last week's meeting was potentially a violation of the Illinois Open Meetings Act because the board had failed to post its agenda in public view for at least 48 hours before a meeting. The Herald and Review sent a request for a review by Public Access Counselor to the Attorney General's office last week. But the board said Township Attorney Jeff Jurgens came to the township building on Wednesday to see how the agenda was posted and said it was visible through the glass, but that it could have been difficult to read. That's why we're having this special meeting with the agenda posted in order to redo what was done at that meeting, Cemetery Board Trustee Bruce Pillsbury said. During the public comment portion of the meeting Tuesday, 10 people stood and pleaded with the board to rethink its decision, and many others spoke out against it during discussion. Trustee Concetta Geis met with Lynn about the cemetery budget at the March 21st meeting, and the other two trustees complimented her on the budget recommendations. Karen Rivera said, "There was no mention of the April meeting of a cash shortage or the need to eliminate the cemetery director position. Financial figures don't support your decision." Decatur Township Trustee Amy Roof is on the board that appointed the cemetery board, but voted against it and didn't agree with its decision to fire Dixon. The town board has never asked them to cut their budget, nor has the cemetery board ever indicated they were thinking about eliminating a job or a change of plan, Ruff said. Then, 13 days before they made the decision, we had approved a tentative budget that would have paid for the cemetery director's position completely through the entire year with no questions or complaints. But the board stood by its decision. The tax levy has continued to go down, Funk said. Every taxing body has to live with less. Next year, we're going to be paying $6,000 more in salaries than we take in. What about the lawnmowers, the tractors, and the gas to maintain those plots? We have to have money for that too. So we have to cut costs. Guy said it was nothing personal toward Dixon. It's financial. We don't have many burials as there were in the past, Guys said. Having someone there to answer the phone and help people doesn't justify the expense. In order to meet our budget, we're going to have to do more with less. It's not something we want to do, but we have to. Dixon spoke out on his own behalf, asking the board to reconsider. You're not going to find anyone else that runs the cemetery the way I run it. If you don't care about that cemetery, you don't belong in it. I care about it. You know I do. I want to keep the job, and I want you to change your mind. Funk said a working superintendent would be more beneficial to the cemetery. Someone who could work day to day in the cemetery and do some of the things Lynn was doing. But no one on the board could answer questions about if Dixon could be considered for that job or what that job would pay. We haven't made that position yet, Funk said. Dixon also forced an amendment to the minutes of last week's meeting. He asked the board about the Crowder Trust that it had reported funds would be released for soon. What will those funds be used for? Dixon asked. What do we need it for? Funk answered, then said, I'm sorry, I don't know what it's needed for. Okay, I do, Dixon said. That PNC Wealth Management Irrevocable Trust Statement for Marie S. Crowder is for, and only for, the David Schallenberger Mausoleum. I have emails that have made it clear that money is for the mausoleum, and that mausoleum only. It has 7 to 8 BB holes in the glass that should first and foremost be taken care of with that money. And the last part of the article shows Greenwood Cemetery director Lynn Dixon on October 30th, 2014, opening a gate and looking into the cemetery. The next article is entitled, Shake the Lake Event Moves Locations. Decatur. Shake the Lake is moving locations, but will settle into a permanent spot next year at the new Lakefront Amphitheater. The four nights of free country music concerts are a partnership between the Decatur Park District, Newhoff Media, and Danzig Insurance Services. In the three previous years of the concert series, the shows were held in the parking lot of the Nelson Park Rock Garden. This summer, because of road and sewer work in preparations for the new amphitheater, the shows will be held at the Horseshoe parking lot next to the beach house. Next year, Decatur Park Board Commissioner Chris Riley said at Tuesday's press conference to announce this year's lineup, the concerts will be held in the new amphitheater, which will be built beginning this summer thanks to a $3.9 million grant from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation. Decatur Park District Executive Director Bill Clevenger said he's not sure what that will mean for next year's lineup. The whole conversation still has to be had, Clevenger said. We'll work in the next few months about getting that brought into focus and make some decisions. The acts for this year's Shake the Lake concert series are a mix of local, regional, and up-and-coming stars out of Nashville on the summer docket. The highlight is June 23rd's 95Q Fan Appreciation Concert with Craig Campbell, who had a top 20 single in 2010 with Family Man, and currently has a top 30 single, Outskirts of Heaven. He'll be joined by an artist, 95Q's Toby Tucker, said has all the tools to become a superstar in Sam Groh. Also, at Shake the Lake this summer will be St. Louis-based country and classic rock cover band Borderline, June 9th, Decatur-based Reckless Whiskey, July 4th, along with the fireworks, and up-and-coming Nashville artists Jackie Lee and Justin Adams. The concert series, in its fourth year, has drawn an average of 2,250 people at each show, according to Riley. There will be several food and beverage vendors, including alcoholic beverages, at the concerts. People can also bring their own food and drinks, but not alcohol. If you go, what? Shake the Lake Summer Concert Series. Where? Lakeshore Landing Pier 35 Boardwalk near the beach house on Lake Decatur. When? Borderline, June 9th. Craig Campbell and Sam Groh, June 23rd. Reckless Whiskey, July 4th. Jackie Lee and Justin Adams, July 21st. Doors open at 6 p.m. The next article is entitled, Eyewitness Testifies That Murphy Repeatedly Stomped Victim's Head. Decatur. Nearly 8 years after 61-year-old Jerry Newingham lost his life to a random act by a mob of teens As he rode his bicycle home from work on a gorgeous late summer day, the young man considered the group's leader, listened to a witness who clearly remembered details of the incident, and those who said they forgot everything about the case. Elliot T. Murphy, 23, was previously sentenced to 80 years in prison for stomping Newingham to death on the 500 block of West Sawyer Street and stomping 46-year-old Kevin S. Wilson nearly to death in Garfield Park on August 24, 2009, after he was convicted by a jury in 2011. On the second day of his retrial Tuesday, some of the same witnesses testified for the state, but some needed assistance to recall the details they more easily remembered 5.5 years ago. The state brought details of the original testimony to light by reading transcripts from former trial testimony to witnesses as they appeared on the stand. Murphy was convicted of first-degree murder and attempted first-degree murder, but those convictions were overturned by appellate court judges on the grounds that his trial attorney had a conflict of interest. The state presented witnesses who treated the victims, witnessed one of the attacks, saw the teens running from the scene on the other one, and participated in both attacks. A surgeon testified as to the seriousness of the injuries to Wilson, who was knocked unconscious, suffered multiple facial fractures to his eye sockets, cheekbones, and sinus walls, and was hospitalized for 25 days. Wilson, who was disabled by the stomping attack by about 8 teens, was scheduled to testify Tuesday afternoon. Prosecutors informed Associate Judge Jeffrey Geisler that Wilson was hospitalized for a medical emergency, and would not be available. In her opening statement, First Assistant State's Attorney Nicole Kroenke said that the evidence in the trial will show that not only was Murphy the leader of the mob that killed Jerry Newingham, but he was the most violent participant. She said the attack on Newingham, which was perpetrated by 9 boys, took place just after school let out and after a fight took place between Murphy's group and another teen. As they were walking home, they see Jerry Newingham and he was riding his bicycle, Kroenke told the jurors. He had a backpack on his back and looking down, he does not even see what is coming next. You will learn that his defendant's younger brother runs across the street and hits Mr. Newingham in the face as hard as he can, knocking him out. Then Murphy and at least 2 other teens run across the street and stomped on Newingham's head, Kroenke said. Murphy then stomped on the victim's head while he lay unconscious on the ground a minimum of 10 times and a maximum of 40 times. In his opening statement, Assistant Public Defender Bruce Berry said the 2 horrific incidents occurred, but no physical evidence was ever found linking Elliot Murphy to this. Berry told the jurors that they were a whole bunch of kids who were scared. So when they were questioned by the police, their stories were back and forth and they needed to protect themselves and others. He said, there are people walking the streets today who had blood evidence against them. We have a huge mess here, Barry said. A 24-year-old man testified that he was originally charged with first-degree murder in the case, but later pleaded guilty to a lesser charge. He said he agreed to testify against Murphy because people lied about his role and he wanted to set the record straight as to what he witnessed. As Kroenke screened photographs of Murphy and four of his co-defendants, who received prison sentences ranging from 15 to 65 years for their roles, the witness testified at each one of the images, all taken shortly after the incidents occurred. The witnesses said that as the witness said he was at the Garfield Park Pavilion the afternoon of August 24th, when Murphy, his brother, and about six other teens arrived. He testified that he was 2 or 3 feet away from Wilson, and as Murphy stomped on his head and another stomped on his body, Wilson had been standing up steadily, apparently drunk, and had tried to get away with the mob when the mob arrived on the scene. Did you see the defendant stomping on him? Asked Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz, the second prosecutor in the trial. Yes, the witness said. The man was unconscious. He looked like he was beaten to death. He said that Murphy stomped on the man's head more than 5 times, and most likely more than 10 times. The witness testified that 2 days later, when they were both at MacArthur High School, Murphy told him that before he and other teens came to the Garfield Park, they jumped on somebody on Sawyer Street. Murphy told him that he told his brother to punch the man on Sawyer, and he didn't go over and punch him. He did go over and punch him. Murphy told him that he then stomped on his head, the witness testified. The trial resumes at 9:30 today in Macon County Court. The next article is entitled, School Chiefs Ramp Up Pressure for Budget Stalemate Solution. Macon. More than 360 superintendents statewide have signed a letter calling for legislators to immediately pass a state budget, improve the state's education funding formula, and pay school districts millions of dollars in unpaid bills. Meridian Superintendent Dan Brew said the state owes Meridian more than $412,000 and has been operating without a full budget for 22 months. I support the Pass Illinois Budget movement because our legislators and our governor have not done their jobs, Brew said. The budget impasse needs to end immediately and move forward with a budget that will serve the students in Illinois public K-12 schools fairly and equitably. The 360 superintendents represent more than 1 million students, and many are using their school marquees and social media accounts to share their frustration. The state has not paid mandated categories, which include special education, bilingual education, transportation, and other required services. The state hasn't had a budget in about 2 years. And that's the end of part one of the Wednesday, April 26th edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. I'll be back with part two after the break.